a Saturday, her young beau called to see if she'd like to go to see a show. But Miss Kate said no. I'll tell you what you can do. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
Since then he's hit a good 12 more. Chilton Joe DiMaggio.
Joe DiMaggio, we want you on our side.
From coast to coast, that's all you'll hear of Joe, the one-man show. He's glorified the horse-hide sphere. Chilton Joe DiMaggio.
Joe DiMaggio.
Yankee baseball, the Clipper and the Mick. Talking baseball. But it's a natural fact, when Jackie comes to bat, the other team is through.
Can't you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? Yes, and that ain't all. He's no home.
Yes, yes, Jackie's real gone.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Henry Rain Show here on WWPR 1490 AM. Heard every Saturday, 12:05 to 1 o'clock. And we have a very special edition today, a little change of pace, but something I've been looking forward to all week. And our guests may not know it, but I've been looking for it for quite a few years, ever since I knew this gentleman was in our community and would make such a great interview with such a full and interesting life, but especially appropriate this time of the year during baseball season. Because the gentleman I'm going to introduce to you in just a moment has quite a baseball story to tell, as well as a labor story and a civil rights story. I want to remind you before we get into this, though, that you can follow the show on Facebook at Henry Rain Show. You can also follow on Twitter at similarly named at Henry Rain Show. You can get the show on the podcast site on demand. That would be henryrainshow.podomatic.com. And we will not waste any more time, but Leon Harris was a gentleman that I first came aware of when I was helping out on C.J. Zaia's congressional campaign back in 2004. And not only was he a political activist at the time, I came to find out that he was also quite a baseball player. In fact, he had played for the Kansas City Monarchs, which some of you may know was the team that Jackie Robinson played for briefly before he moved on to the major leagues, and some of the greatest stars of the Negro League era played on that team. They were considered the Yankees of the Negro League, and many of those stars went on, as well as many of the other stars from the other clubs. But we're going to find out more about that. But it's not just that. Mr. Harris has a BA from the National Labor College. He also studied in the Harvard University Labor Program. He worked as an athletic director at the Rhode Island Training Schools for Boys. His labor career included international representative for the AFSCME and the AFL-CIO. He's been a director of research for education and civil rights for those organizations, AFL-CIO, former president of the Greenwich Village NAACP, that's the Greenwich Village in New York City, board member of the National Life Membership of the NAACP, former president of the Negro Labor Committee. He negotiated the first union contract in the world that recognized Dr. Martin Luther King as a holiday 1 month after his death. He's former executive director, Inner City Labor Housing Alliance, former vice president of Manatee's Kiwanis Club, now the Lakewood Ranch Kiwanis Club. He's former executive board member of Study of the African-American Life and History, a member of the organization of African-American men that have been and still achievers called JAF, Just About Friends. He's a former president of the Manatee Sarasota Democratic Black Caucus of Florida, which I believe is when I first became aware of him. Former executive board member of the State of Florida Democratic Black Caucus, and a devoted family man. And as I started at the first of this lengthy introduction, he is a former member of the Kansas City Monarchs, and he was a pitcher for that team. And I want to welcome him to the Henry Raines Show. And let me get that mic a little bit closer to you, Leon. And good afternoon, Leon. Thank you for coming here today.
Good morning, Henry.
And by the way, you have a great voice for radio, Leon. I wish I could borrow that sometime. And so I know you were a little bit hesitant when I first called you up out of the blue. Vicki Waters, I want to thank her for getting your number for me, which is why I hadn't spoken to you all these years. I wanted you to talk to you. And but here you are, and I appreciate it.
Well, Vicki and Sasha are my great friends, and they've been so helpful for the Democratic Party. I think really not only the Democratic Party, but the political party in this area. They have been so helpful, and I appreciate them and respect them and love them so much and think about them very often.
Well, in the second half of the show, we're going to get into some of the more typical topics we talk about on this show, but I want to get back into your youth. And for I don't think you're keeping this a secret. You're 87 years old, so by my math, it puts your birthday right around 1930. And also, this is the 70th anniversary. I believe Jackie Robinson made it to the major leagues in 1947. So this is the 70th year of the breaking of the color barrier in Major League Baseball. But you were born and raised in Nyack, New York. Where is that?
Nyack is in Rockland County on the New Jersey side. When you cross the George Washington Bridge from Manhattan, you come right into New Jersey. And then about 12 miles going north, you come into New York State. And Nyack was only about 18 miles from New York State.
And when, do you have an early memory when you first became aware of baseball?
Well, my father was a pitcher. He told me stories about him being a pitcher. And his grandfather also played ball for the old Red Caps. They were...
Oh, sure, the old Red Caps. Who were the old Red Caps?
Oh, they traveled all over the United States, and they also went into South America.
So that would have been right after the turn of the century.
Oh, no, oh my God, yes. My grandfather was born around 1870-something, around that time.
So even probably before the turn of the century,
that's right.
When he was in his glory days at baseball. So was that an all-African-American team?
Yes, it was.
And so, I mean, we've just opened up a corner that I had no idea existed. So there, before, I mean, maybe coexisting with the Negro League, but there was an African-American team that actually toured South America?
Way back, they were called the Highlanders. And this the Negro League was organized in 1920 by Rube Foster in Kansas City.
So your grandfather was playing on this thing
way before
20 or 30 years before that.
Oh, yes, they were playing. They played all over, but they didn't get any compensation. They just played. I was told this by my grandfather.
But they didn't have to pay their own way to get down there, did they?
Oh, they got paid.
Oh.
Oh, they got paid, just like the Kansas City Monarchs or all the teams in the Negro League. They all got compensation. My compensation was $400 a month.
You were rolling in it.
Oh, back in 1953, 54, it wasn't too bad. But our meal money was $3 a day.
What?
And
what were sandwiches, 25 cents?
That's right. Hot dogs were 10
yeah,
cents.
Yeah, I remember my dad coming out of the Marines after World War II thinking he was making $40 a week at a paper mill. So you were living large there.
Didn't do too bad at that time.
Yeah. But let me take you back to your grandfather now. Why was there a demand for an African-American team to be touring in South? I assume they toured the U.S. also.
I really don't know. My grandfather and I had a distant relationship. He lived in Harlem, worked for the Red Caps, Sky Caps, or well, they weren't called Sky Caps at that time. They were called Red Caps. And they just formed neighborhood teams, and they just toured all over the different states. I shouldn't say different states. What I know is that we're in New Jersey and Delaware and Washington, D.C. And then they went to South America one year. He told me about that. He told me he played center field. But that was about all that he had told me. He didn't give me the real history. And at that time, I just wasn't interested. No, I shouldn't say I wasn't interested. But it just didn't come to me to ask him more questions about his life as a baseball player, because I just didn't think about it early age.
Yeah, I mean, most kids don't think about it. No. It's hard for children to even think of their mothers and fathers as people that had dreams and ambitions and weren't just worried about getting the schoolwork done or getting you to bed.
In fact, when you mention that, dreams and ambition, it reminds me when I first went to see my first pro game. I saw the New York Yankees against the Philadelphia Athletics in 1939.
So you're about 9 years old?
Right. I was 9 years old. And I saw Joe DiMaggio, Charlie Keller, Tommy Hendricks, Bill Dickey, and Red Roth, Frankie Grossetti. It was after Lou Gehrig's left, and Babe Dahlgren, Johnny Stern. Old-timers will know those players. And then I saw other games with the Detroit Tigers with Hank Greenberg, the Chicago White Sox. I saw them. And my family also took me to see the Negro League teams. They played doubleheaders in Yankee Stadium.
By the way, I don't know if you're aware of this. Probably are, because you're aware of a lot of stuff. The Tampa Bay Rays last Saturday had, I guess, their first true doubleheader. Doubleheaders nowadays, you are like having two movies. You run the one crowd out and you empty the seats, then you bring a new crowd in and new revenue in. But this was, you get two games for the price of one, which I had been to in my youth. You obviously have, because you were telling us about it. But, yeah, that was sort of magical. Two games for the price of one. You
That's
get all day
right.
at the baseball park.
And so four different teams. I remember seeing Josh Gibson, Buck Leonard.
Josh Gibson was the African-American Babe Ruth.
That's
Or maybe Babe Ruth was the white Josh
That's
Gibson
right.
or whatever.
And our team was the black, like the black Yankees,
right.
the New York Yankees. In fact, there was a team called the New York Black Yankees.
Right.
They were in the Negro League.
Now, before you go down that route any farther, because I wanted to set the stage for a little bit, but your dad was a pitcher. Who did he pitch for?
Oh, just locally.
Did he pitch in school? Or?
Oh, no. Yeah. He just pitched. And he taught me how to throw a curveball.
Now, I imagine Nyack probably is pretty urban now, isn't it?
No, it's still the same. We had about 5,000 people when I was there, and it's about 5,000 now. But there are more African-Americans there now. About 1,500 now.
Okay. So when I was growing up here in Bradenton, Florida, we had the boys' club, but you only got over there. That was a ways to go, and you only got over there a couple days a week, and you could play on their teams. But commonly, in the kids in my school, whatever neighborhoods they were in, they'd just find an empty lot, and they'd self-organize and play baseball every day. And that was just the way you played baseball. You organized yourself. You didn't need any adults. You didn't need uniforms or any of these other rules and regulations. And it was that way it was when you were growing
up. That's right. No, not when I was growing up. When my father was growing up, it was that way.
Okay. Now, what do you, when you wanted to play baseball in grammar school and into junior high, how did it play?
Well, it came in high school, really, when I started playing.
You didn't have, like, vacant lots? You just go
out? Oh, we had playgrounds. We played softball.
Okay.
We had a lot of softball. During the summertime, we had a playground where we had two ball fields, tennis court, swimming pool, basketball court.
But you didn't need adults to create the teams and put you on them and schedule you and stuff like that, did you?
No.
So what do you think about for kids these days? You got... we're going to talk about it later, but you got grandkids, great-grandkids, great-great-grandchildren. Everything is organized. I never see kids self-organizing a football game or a baseball game, maybe a basketball game, because you can get that together pretty easy.
Right.
But do you think something's missing for kids like that?
Well, you're talking about neighborhoods. And when you really look at how our neighborhoods have diminished in population. That was one of the major causes. We had kids around us. We could get 18 people, 18 young kids our age. Today is very difficult, especially in a community like Nyack. At that time, we had about 400 to 500 African-American families. And we had, in fact, my graduating class, we only had 5 African-American kids out of 173.
Let me just interrupt for the audience for a second. I'm going to move Leon's mic, and it's going to make a noise, so that's what you're going to hear right now.
All right.
Okay, sorry about that, Leon.
Okay.
But as long as we're going to talk, that's going to come and go, so let's get it right now. So, I live pretty close to where I grew up, and kids back then, we crossed streets. We went into, I'd been into half the homes in the neighborhood. Now if you see a kid walking around too much, you start getting suspicious.
Well, today is totally different than when we were growing up. My God, that was 70 years ago. It's totally different. We really had a neighborhood, even though it was integrated, but we could always get 20 or 25 boys to play ball. We could always get 20 or 25 kids to play football. We had no problem at that time. But getting back to when I started in high school, I just pitched. We had two other pitchers. We never lost the ball game.
Did Dad give you tips?
He taught me how to throw a curveball. And I already had good speed. In fact, I could tell you a story. Don Newcomb's brother, his name was Harold Newcomb, told me I was faster than Don.
Now, Don Newcomb, wasn't he one of the first African Americans after Jackie Robinson?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes, he played for the Newark Eagles at that time. But he saw me pitch and said that. Along with my fastball and the curveball that my father taught me, I was very effective. Never lost the high school game. In semi-pro ball, I never lost a game.
What about college?
Yes. Well, we didn't have a college team, baseball team. We had just football, basketball, and track and swimming.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you were telling me off the air when we talked before here was that your dad was the first African-American police officer in Nyack. Is that correct?
In 1935.
And what did you say your grandfather did?
He worked for the Whitney Foundation in New York City.
Which would have been a white-collar job?
Oh, my God. Yeah, the Whitney's family, the Rockefeller, the Morgan family, they were the outstanding, and the Vanderbilt family, they were the Donald Trumps of today.
Now, I know when I off the air again, I won't make too many references to off the air conversation. I said, well, your dad was a professional, and you were saying, well, he was a cop. But I would submit to you and to the audience that if you ask any police officer you find around Bradenton or sheriff's deputy, they'll tell you they're a professional. And may not agree, but
no, at $15 a week, I don't think you're a professional. Even that's all he got, and they got that every 2 weeks. He got $30 every 2 weeks.
Okay. Well, it's still a job of responsibility and importance. And that could be another alternate definition. We have alternate facts these days. We have alternate definitions of professional. But the point I'm trying to make is this would have been the when you were a young grammar school age person, it was in the midst of the Depression. But as a role model, you had your dad.
Oh yes.
Who was from everything you told me, he was a linchpin of the family.
Yes.
You have a grandfather that not only had an interesting background as far as his athletic ability, but had a very respectable job. Your contemporaries that would have been, say, in this area of Florida, would not have dreamed that that was an option for a young African-American man. But it was commonplace to you. Have you thought about that before? I'm sure you have.
Oh, later on I thought about it. Couldn't help but think about how they struggled and how they struggled. My grandfather and my father were people that had suits, vests. They dressed very well. They were extremely handsome men. They lived in the area, which was nice. It was $25 a month rent that we paid. But it had big rooms, and we were kind of fortunate, even though our income, our family income, was very meager. But when you get hot dog, a pound of Frankfurters for 10 cents a pound, and hamburger 15 cents a pound, loaf of bread for 10 cents a pound, the movies at that time, we go to the movies, it was only 10 cents to go to the movies. It seemed like a lot of money. And not only that, but my mother worked as a domestic. And
well, now, what does that mean?
Well, she was a domestic worker. She worked for middle-income or upper-middle-income white families, cleaning up their place, doing dishes, cleaning the house, and all of that. When they got rid of their furniture, their carpeting, their silverware, their dishes, they would give them to my mother. So when people came to our house, they thought that we were rich. But that's how it was during that time.
Now, did you have a sense of discrimination growing up in Nyack?
I could answer that by saying yes, in a sense, because we could not attend the YMCA. And then we also could not join the Boy Scouts. So what happened was we had a community center in the black community, Nyack, where we had entertainment, dances, and parties there. And let me see.
Would it have ever occurred to you to ask out a white girl or a white boy?
No. We didn't have that.
Okay. I would have been totally surprised if you said it in the 1930s, up in North. But so you had a sense of discrimination. But did you ever have a sense of what was actually brutal oppression that we had down here and some other parts of the country? But I know as a child of the South, I have a pretty good sense of what was going on. And, you know, the actual use of violence to keep the situation in check, the way the people at the top were trying to. Did you ever get it? When did you get a sense of that?
When I went to Washington, D.C., I was about 17 years old. I went to Washington, D.C. to see my buddy at Howard University. And
Washington, D.C., a southern city.
Yes, at that time. That's when you go into the train station, they separated you from coming from the north to the south. That's when Jim Crow, they called that the Jim Crowism days. And I sensed that. And also in Nyack, even though I mentioned before about the YMCA, we couldn't join the Boy Scouts, so we had also a Boy Scout troop. We called it Troop 5 at that time. That's when I began to see something was different. We weren't like my counterparts. Most of my buddies were white. We lived mainly in an Italian area. And we all lived right next to one another. So I didn't really see it until I saw it in Washington. And then I didn't realize the following year when I went to Hampton University. It was Hampton Institute at that time. When I got down to Old Fort Comfort and had to go across on a boat and saw the signs colored white, and I said to myself, wow, how can this be? But I learned later, Henry, that during that time, I loved it. I didn't like segregation. I wanted a simulation. That's when I think I was becoming aware of my civil rights action. That when I saw this separation because of color, I really was taken by that. But living at Hampton, all black school, 1868.
Historically black college.
Yes. And I just loved being around my own folks. I felt very comfortable. I felt free. And I probably at that time was deciding that the rest of my life I would want to devote my time toward black people, not even thinking about civil rights, because that wasn't even mentioned at that time.
We're getting a little bit away from baseball, and we're going to have plenty of time to get back to the civil rights and the labor organizing. So let me take us into, I guess we'll start with the actual Negro League before we get to Jackie Robinson, and we'll talk a little bit more baseball here, and we'll be getting political towards the third half of the show here, because it looks like we're going to be running over a little bit. So here's a brief piece. It's about the Negro Leagues during the Depression and into World War II, which really saw some of the greatest growth of the league.
In 1933, Gus Greenlee from the Negro League, after Rube Foster's illness and subsequent death. Greenlee created the Pittsburgh Crawfords and put together one of the best teams in baseball history. Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, and Oscar Charleston, all presently in the Major League Hall of Fame, were part of Greenlee's dynasty. Greenlee's biggest contribution was developing the Negro League All-Star Game in 1933. The East-West Game, held at Comiskey Park in Chicago, developed into the biggest black entertainment event of the year almost immediately.
That was an event. That was like preparing for Christmas or preparing for 4th of July. You put on your best clothes because you know you see those people. Well, I mean, of course, when you're talking about 30s, this is prior to television. So the only places you could really see the Joe Louis's and the Bo Jingle Robinsons and the Hattie McDaniel would be at a sporting event.
Another war was brewing in Europe. Adolf Hitler, the leader of Germany, promoted a notion of a physically and mentally superior race of people, Aryans. Germans were supposedly these Aryans, and not too coincidentally, Hitler was their leader. The 1936 Olympics, held in Germany, was Hitler's opportunity to show the world his Aryan supremacy theory was not a farce. There was someone, however, who had a different agenda. Jesse Owens, a black man from humble beginnings in Decatur, Alabama, took his cleats and dashed Hitler's Aryan showcase in Berlin by winning 3 gold medals. Owens' phenomenal display was embarrassment for Hitler. It did not, however, delay Hitler's plans. The year 1937 rolled in with promise. The New Deal programs of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had revived the country's economy from the Depression. Another black man fought for and won the heavyweight championship. Joe Louis won the heavyweight title by knocking out James Braddock. It was a long road for Louis to even get the fight. He couldn't afford to show the same brash that Jack Johnson had exhibited earlier. Joe, or the Brown Bomber as he was called, was soft-spoken, reserved, and patriotic. World War II began in 1939, and the United States had committed to assist the Allied forces with materials, but wouldn't commit any troops. The Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, helped the United States make their decision. It was World War I on a larger and more volatile scale. Patriotism would again be required of men that were Jim Crowed in every area of existence. Off they were again, overseas, to keep democracy safe. the draft was instituted to fill the needs of the war to end all wars. Negro League baseball would achieve the peak of its success during this period. The economy was on the upswing. People were working. Large numbers of fans were attending regular season games, and the East-West All-Star Game was attracting between 40,000 and 50,000 people a year. Major League Baseball had much of its able-bodied talent taken away to join the war effort. Players like New York Yankee great Joe DiMaggio, shown here in uniform, were called upon to serve their country. Instead of offering capable black players the opportunity to play, Major League teams filled their rosters with 4Fs, or men that were physically unable to be drafted. Many of the Negro League's top players, like Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson, were still around, and the public wanted to see the best baseball available. Revenues for black baseball grew to over $2 million a year, making it one of the largest black-dominated industries of its time. Segregation still existed, while men of all races were fighting together and dying all over the world. Keensaw Mountain Landis died in 1944, and A.B. Happy Chandler was named Commissioner of Baseball. Happy's view toward blacks in Major League Baseball wasn't hostile, thereby inviting more possibility of a black player in the major leagues soon.
And we will take up that in just a moment. But so, Leon, we're speaking, by the way, we're speaking with Leon Harris, if you're just tuning in, former Kansas City Monarch pitcher from the Negro League, and also we'll find out more about in a moment, a St. Louis Cardinal prospect that was recruited after Jackie Robinson entered the major leagues, and also a labor activist, civil rights activist, and we'll find out more about all that. But so in that period of time, during World War II, you would have been going into junior high school, I would guess, or just about to go into it, getting out of grammar school, going into junior high. What are your memories of baseball then during World War II, attending any of the Negro League games, and your ambition to become a baseball player, as well as do you remember that East-West Negro League All-Star game?
Oh, I surely do, because I used to sell the Negro papers, the Pittsburgh Courier, the Amsterdam News, the Journal and Guide from Norfolk, and the New York Age. And that's how I got news from people, sports writers like Wendell Smith and Joe Bostic and Rick Roden and Sam Lacy and Ernest Brown in Kansas City. I would read those papers, and I got tremendous amount of information and tremendous amount of appreciation for what was going on. But I never thought of being a baseball player.
Now, what point of view? People probably don't know this either, that when we're talking about newspapers at that time, there were multiple newspapers in a big urban area like New York, but even in local areas like St. Petersburg or Tampa, you would have competing papers, and maybe an evening paper, a morning paper, et cetera. So there were multiple points of view available to people, just like on, well, probably less multiple points of view than there are on cable news, but it was fragmented. Was there a general point of view in the African-American papers that you can recall?
No, I can't recall at that time, Henry.
It was pretty straightforward?
Yes. Okay. I was more interested in the headlines at that time about the artists, the beautiful women, the models. You know, when you're young like that, you don't think of...
Oh, no, kids aren't like that now.
You don't think of the news now, the international world and all of that. You just didn't think about
it. So you were making the point, though, that you were aware of that All-Star game from the newspaper.
Oh, yes.
So how did that capture the imagination? Did the other people in the community talk about it much?
No, they didn't talk about it.
Huh.
Not in Nyack.
The people that bought the papers weren't?
Yeah, they bought the papers.
But they weren't interested in that part?
No. Just like, it was more or less like a tabloid paper. Mm-hmm. So they were more interested in pictures and the underlying, the excerpts from the pictures.
Like
from
the New York
the
Post
papers.
Or something nowadays.
Yeah, that's right. And the Daily News.
So you would have been about 17 when Jackie Robinson broke through to the major leagues.
I was exactly there.
When did you find out about that? I don't mean the instant, but when did that come into your consciousness?
At that same age, 17, we had a speech teacher, Miss McLaren, and we had to write a speech, and then we had a speech dinner, and I wrote about Jackie Robinson being born in Cairo, Georgia.
Now, was the teacher African-American?
No, oh, no, we didn't have any African-American teachers in NIAC. During my whole tenure there, we didn't have any. And I spoke about
Why
Jackie
were you chosen
Robinson.
To do the speech?
Well, we all had to do that. We got marked by that.
Okay.
We got graded by our speech. And I wrote about Jackie Robinson. And not knowing that about 6 years later, I would be on the team that he just left.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. In fact, when our team came to Yankee Stadium, where I had seen all these great ball players that were my heroes, my family was there, and it was almost like a dream come true when they saw me in the Kansas City Monarch uniform at Yankee Stadium. And I was just so elated. I couldn't believe here's where Lou Gehrig, Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, all these great, Spud Chandler, Red Ruffing. I saw all those guys, Hank Greenberg. I always loved, in fact, I really wanted to be a first baseman instead of a pitcher. I loved Frank McCormick with the Cincinnati Reds, Dick Siebert with the Philadelphia Athletics. All the old-timers will remember these. If you have listeners,
you might have
old-timers.
More longevity at first base, too.
That's right. But it was just great being there in Yankee Stadium. And then right after that, I got one of my
now
best.
Now, you were playing in Yankee Stadium.
Yeah.
Now, why did they get to play in Yankee Stadium?
Oh, we played at all the major league ballparks, the Kansas City Monarchs. We played.
So what was the schedule like?
Well, the schedule was rigged because we never played two consecutive days in the same city.
Is that the same for the other teams, too?
Yes. And we would move from one city to another. In fact, we left New York, went to Philadelphia, then we went to Washington. We played at Griffith Stadium in Washington. We played at Shibe Park in Philadelphia. And it was a Monday. That's when I pitched on that Monday night in Shibe Park. And we traveled throughout the whole South, throughout the Midwest, different cities, different villages, different hamlets, different ballparks, every day. In fact, our uniforms weren't like they are today. Every day you see a major league team, and I used to call it the Sanction League, not the major league. They didn't become major league until blacks and Hispanics become, when they begin to enter into the so-called major leagues. I always thought it was a sanctioned league. Even at that time, I said to myself, Leon, you're looking at Negro League ball players, and you're watching the New York Yankees, Detroit Tigers, and went to the Polar Grounds to watch the New York Giants, and you saw better ball players, faster, more powerful, they had more speed. And they, in fact, my papers showed what when I was on the paper route, they had articles about Dizzy Dean and against Satchel Paige at the end of the season, how they played against each other, 7 to 11 games, and the black teams would beat the white teams. They had the Satchel Paige All Stars and Dizzy Dean All Stars,
and we should point out Dizzy Dean was a pitcher, son of the South.
That's right.
He grew up, but he knew how to make money.
That's right. And they got more money barnstorming after the major league season. And the Negro League team All-Stars would play against Dizzy Dean's All-Stars. And
do you know if they got played equally?
Well, you got more. Well, at that time.
I mean, did Satchel make as much money as Dizzy?
Satchel made more money than any ball player. I think he made more money than Babe Ruth, because Satchel sold himself wherever he went. He played with the Monarchs. He played for the Pittsburgh Crawfords. He played for the Homestead Grays. He played for any team, the House of David. He played all over, pitched for 3, 4, 5 innings. He was a drawing attraction, would get the gate. He traveled not
so
on the bus.
So he would save himself, too, and not pitch a whole game.
He never traveled on the bus like we did. He had his own car and his own chauffeur.
All right. So it reminds me of some major leaguers that have private planes that land at the Sarasota Brandon Airport when they're coming in for spring training. All right, so, but really, he broke through in 47, and so all of a sudden, well, actually, I have Willie Mays speaking to this, and I'll take it up. This is a very brief clip, but I want y'all to hear it because I'm sure you can comment on this.
When Mack and them came in, they'd taken all the great ball players out of the league because they want to use them to draw in their particular cities now. You take Ernie Banks, he played with Chicago. Gene Baker, they were short and second at the particular time. Hank Aaron, I think he played with Indianapolis Clowns. They've taken all the stars out of the league and put them into the major league.
Okay, so we're at that time that Willie Mays was just describing. Jackie Robinson's come in, and now they realize they're on to something. They start trolling the Negro League to get the best players there and looking around for other great players. And someone saw you. How did that happen?
Well, while I was in Rhode Island, I went to a tryout camp, and the Cardinals picked me up.
St. Louis Cardinals?
Yes. Joe Cusick was the scout, and Quincy Troop was also a scout, and they were there, and they liked me very much, and I got a nice little bonus, which paid for my first home, because I was married at that time, and I had 2 children.
And so you got a home, you paid for it completely with the bonus?
No.
Got the down payment.
Well, I didn't pay for it with that bonus. It was a very small bonus. But my mortgage was $42.29 a month.
So, okay. And so you think you're onto something now, right? I mean, you're in the Cardinals organization.
Yeah.
And where what was the next stop in the Cardinals organization? This would have been what, 49?
No, it was the same year that I went with the Monarchs, 53.
Okay.
Yes. The Cardinals, they
so
used to...
So you've been playing semi-pro about baseball?
Yeah.
That you were still sharp?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So they recruited you, you're in their system, what happens?
We go to spring training in DeLand, Florida. And the reason we were in DeLand was because prior to the Dodgers going to Vero Beach, they wanted to come to DeLand. But the city council down there didn't want integration. And therefore, Branch Rickey and them moved to Vero Beach. When the people in DeLand later saw that blacks were being accepted on these teams, the Cardinals got me and 3 others, a guy named Eloy Robinson from Danville, Virginia, Jerry Hood from Washington, D.C., and Len Tucker from Fresno, California. We were down there as the first blacks to come to DeLand. And I was pitching down there.
Was this regular spring training?
It's spring training, yes.
Okay.
And, in fact, a guy named Jim Dupree, he played the Cotton League the year before that. We teamed up and pitched a 7-inning no-hitter together. And the Cardinals really liked me. But at that time, the Cardinals had Bill Greason and Brooks Lawrence. If you go back into history, you see that they were two black pitchers for the Cardinals. The Cardinals had already signed their first black ball player named Tom Alston, who was the first baseman. And the thought of having three black pitchers was unbelievable. So it was not like the Dodgers that later had Don Newcomb, Joe Black, and Bankhead. They were all over pitchers there.
It would be like having an all-black basketball
team. That's right,
team.
That's right.
Nobody would come
they didn't want that.
That, right?
No,
yeah.
No way.
So did you go down to the minors from there?
Yes, I went to Peoria. And then, but I found, they found out that I could only pitch every 7 days and not 4 days.
How many innings would you pitch?
At that time, I would only pitch about 3 or 4 or 5 innings, and that was the most.
As a starter or reliever?
Well, I started with Peoria as a starter. In fact, I started with the Monarchs as a starter. But my arm even went bad there. Buck O'Neill was my manager. He had me do relief pitching, and he called me the stopper. Anytime our pitchers got in trouble, they called on me to.
They still have stoppers now.
Yeah, well, they got the relief pitchers, yes, but I was chosen by Buck to pitch 2 or 3 innings. But
now, if you had that kind of skill level, but did they have? Now we have designated closers on baseball teams. Did they have that back then?
Not necessarily. So we had 8 pitchers on our team. So you get once a week. You would pitch. You would start. I didn't start, but a couple of games with the Monarchs. Just a few games I started. I was more or less a relief pitcher. But we had great pitchers. In fact, we're going to meet at the All-Star game in July in Miami. The ex-Negro, ex-Negro League ball players are going to meet in Miami, and at the All-Star game, and I'll see a couple of guys that I play with. We only got about 40 or 50 of us that are still living. Now,
they played in the Negro League.
Yes. We're called now Legends of the Negro League. But the 2 years that I spent there, I don't consider that. But if they want to designate me as a legend, then I'll be a legend.
You waited long enough for it. You might as well wear it. So how did your arm, not how did it go bad? It went bad from pitching. But what do you know what the damage was in your arm?
Lack of calcium. And
they don't have that problem this year.
No,
this year.
The Tommy John surgery and everything else. But no, I probably lack calcium in that my right arm. I was a right hand pitcher.
That's why didn't you drink more milk?
That's right. I didn't like milk. That was one of the reasons too, Henry.
Parents?
That's right.
To your parents.
Well, the reason I didn't like milk was because in those days, milk was not pasteurized. We had a lot of cream on the top, and I wanted pure milk.
There you go. So, did you notice the problems when you were playing semi-pro ball, or did
no.
it, because you
no.
you had to take it up another level when
no.
you got to the majors?
No. I never felt that way when I was in semi-pro ball. I would go the 9 innings. I would go 9 innings, but it was every week. Mm-hmm. It wasn't every 4 days. Right. I didn't, you know.
Do you think in the current environment where everybody's so specialized on the pitching staff that there might have been a place for a pitcher like you?
Oh, yes. Now I see it now. Oh, I would have, if I had gotten into the major leagues, I would have.
How did you feel
great.
When you realized that, how did you come to the decision, because you were on the Monarchs, did they let you go or did you decide it was just time?
I decided it was time. I wanted to be with my family. I had 2 children at that time, and I had passed the test to be athletic director at this training school for boys. And I placed number one, and I just wanted to do it. I was earning more money there than I was playing baseball. I had a family to take care of.
More than $400 a month?
Yes, I was earning more than that. At that
wow. Time. All right. Well, then that explains a lot. Let's wrap up this segment with a piece on Jackie Robinson here, and we'll be back with more with Leon Harris.
Well, we got a lot to do.
When Jackie Robinson took the field for the Brooklyn Dodgers on opening day, April 15, 1947, he forever changed the face of Major League Baseball. Robinson was the first African American to play in the majors in the 20th century, shattering the so-called color barrier, a 50-year-old tradition of segregation. Initially shunned by fans and even his own teammates, the infielder focused instead on being the best in the game. Robinson's raw talent soon gave Dodger fans reason to look beyond his skin color. By the end of his first season, he had racked up 12 home runs and a league-leading 29 steals and took home the league's Rookie of the Year award. In 1949, he was named the National League's most valuable player with a batting average of .342. Despite his all-star status, life for Jackie Robinson was far from easy. On the road, he was forced to stay in separate hotels. And he had agreed his contract to turn the other cheek when faced with racial insults and threats of physical violence. Robinson kept his word and his dignity. In the decade he was with the Dodgers, the team played in 6 World Series, finally winning the championship in 1955.
And it's all over but the shouting and the tumult. The Dodgers win it 2-0 and win their first World Series. And this day will live long in the memory of Brooklyn, USA.
You've been listening to a very special segment of the Henry Raine Show here with Leon Harris about the Negro League, early days of the integration of the major leagues of baseball. We're going to come back on the other side of this song. We're going to look more at the next phase of Leon Harris's life as a civil rights activist and a labor organizer. You're listening to The Henry Raine Show.